Okay, friends, I'm still flying a little high from my the last show, which for you is a couple days ago, for me was a couple of minutes ago, with Tim Barnett, and of course he's the host of Red Pen Logic, and we worked through a TikTok this time that we're going to post on RPL, and boy, I sure enjoy hanging with Tim and thinking through these things and knocking these things around. And I hope you enjoyed that. If you haven't listened to that podcast, I really encourage you to do so, because we do an assessment or a critique of a very popular TikTok criticism. Maybe that's not the right way to put it, but it's a point of view that Jesus was a racist and repented of his racism when he was confronted by a Syrophoenician Gentile woman who spoke truth to power, as the saying goes. And we deconstructed that whole thing in the second sense of the word, where we looked at it very closely and I came to very different conclusions than the author of that piece. So anyway, that was fun. We'll do more like that in the future with Tim. Since I spent that whole hour having a great time with him, I didn't do any announcements. So we got five callers on. I want to get to them very quickly here, and they've been very patient, and I appreciate that. But I just wanted to mention, before I forget, on Saturday, April 10th, I'm going to be at Living Water Community Church in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Okay? So that's coming up for me. Let me just see something. There's another thing I'm doing next week. Where am I going? I'm going to New Jersey or something. I think I'm going to New Jersey next week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, probably a Thursday event coming back on Friday. So if you go to our website, str.org, there's a place that you can go to figure out where I'm going, you know, and where I'll be speaking. Should be easy to find. I don't go to our website, so I don't know how to navigate that. But I encourage you, if you're in the New Jersey area, I'll be there next week. And then on April 10th, I'm going to be in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, doing tactics conference there too. So just so you know. And this end of this month, we'll have two more classes for SDRU, Standard Reason University, and they will be the tactics course that I'll be doing, and the Bible and Homosexuality. Alan Schliemann is the instructor for that. Just go to SDR.org, and easiest way to get to SDRU is there's an icon in the upper right-hand corner. There's actually two there, one to subscribe, but just to the left of it is another one for Standard Reason University. Just click that and follow the prompts, and you'll do well with that. So anyway, that's all I want to deal with at the moment. Let's get to our callers now, and let me see. I'm confused by this because number five is flashing, but number five is, I think Amy's talking to somebody on number five, right? I should just go to number five, okay, and hit that middle button. Okay, Kim. Kim in Alberta, Canada. Do I got you there, buddy?
Hello. Yes. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thank you. I'm glad to talk to you, and thanks for your patience here.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. I just want to say thank you to you, your staff, your organization. It's been instrumental in my growth.
Oh, great.
And I've supported you guys financially when I've been able to, and certainly prayerfully.
Well, thank you. It's that funny Canadian money, but we're glad for it anyway.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't go quite as far as your American
dollars.
No,
no worries. Well, so glad. Thank you. Thanks, Kim.
Right on. Greg, I'm a bit perplexed in how to ask my question, because I probably should have taken a little more time to formulate it. But
okay.
I think I have, to some degree, written it down here. And it's tied to, really, in light of Romans 13, mm-hmm. and I think it's 1 Peter or 2 Peter 2 regarding submission to
yeah,
our
first
government
Peter.
Or submission
right.
to authority. And in particular, in context with the COVID, and I've heard you say it before, and it's one that I share the same sentiments that there is COVID and then there's the politics around
right,
it.
Right, right.
So I'm studying wisdom, the book of wisdom, and I'm reflecting on these chapters, and I'm wondering if there are times where wisdom can trump submission to authority, and I guess I've come to the realization that it's easy when the matter is an obvious morality one.
Yeah.
But it's not so easy when it's a matter of, like, if from a bird's eye view, I'm not saying that this is my conviction, but
right.
Say there's a degree of tyranny involved with, and it doesn't have to be COVID. It can be a number of other issues.
Yeah.
Can wisdom trump that authority? And maybe it all comes down to one's conscience on the matter, but the easiest way I can frame the question is, can wisdom trump submission to authority? Using Proverbs as a reference.
Yeah. Well, I think that you're right that this is going to be, to some degree, an individual call, and it's always mm-hmm. going to be an individual call to some degree. When
yeah.
you have to balance out two competing truths, that's called being between a rock and a hard place, okay?
Yeah.
So, or between the devil and the deep blue sea kind of thing. And this is where you are faced with two alternatives, and each alternative is wrong in some sense. But you are forced between the two of them. And then the mm-hmm. question is, what do you do? Now, the moral principle is that you, at least the way I would construe it, and there are two ways to construe the same thing, and mm-hmm. The moral principle is you do the greater good. Now, some people might say you do the lesser evil, but that would imply that by you are still choosing what's evil. Rather than the greater good, which would suggest that if Jesus were in the circumstance, he would be choosing something evil. And I don't think that's the way it works out. When we are faced with those kinds of circumstances and we make the right choice, we are doing something that's good, not something that's evil. So when Rahab lied to protect the spies, for example, mm-hmm. she was doing something good. She wasn't doing the lesser of two evils. Okay.
So now
this little formula, so to speak, is very standard in resolving ethical conflicts. But the way you've characterized it is, how do you deal with something where it's maybe wrong from a wisdom perspective, but not immoral? Okay.
Yeah.
And here's where I think sometimes things that are wrong from a wisdom perspective do have moral ramifications. Remember, even in the book of Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, right? And so the Proverbs are unique in that they are not simply enlightened principles, like a stitch in time saves nine, or a penny saved mm-hmm. is a penny earned, or something like that. Those are helpful, wise Proverbs, but there's no moral quality to them. Characteristically, what's unique in the book of Proverbs is that these have moral quality to them. And so when we are applying the wisdom of Proverbs, it would not be unlikely that there are moral dimensions to the issue, all right?
Okay.
If we are just looking at something that is just generally wise and something that is immoral, if that's all it is, then we are obliged to do the moral thing. And that would be maybe the government isn't doing the wise things, but it's still telling us to do the unwise thing. And so that's the moral principle that we have to follow, obey the government. And incidentally, there are all kinds of things that would fall in that category. The government is wild, at least our government, I suspect yours is similar, is wildly stupid when it comes to accomplishing appropriate ends, you know, just in a mm-hmm. pragmatic fashion, you know.
Yeah.
So we could always be saying, I don't have to obey that. That's dumb, you know. That isn't going mm-hmm. to accomplish the right goal. Now, so I'm making a distinction now. I'm not speaking to the COVID circumstance that you mentioned.
Right.
I'm just speaking in general categories. When you have mm-hmm. a moral obligation on the one hand, and it seems to be trumped by a pragmatic concern on the other. The pragmatic mm-hmm. is not moral. You must go with the moral.
Right.
The only time when you adjudicate between the two is when you have a moral dilemma, and both options have moral dimensions. Right with me so far?
Yeah.
All right. Now, let's just talk about the COVID situation, though. I actually think both options do have moral dimensions here. And I was reading an article about Where are you at? You're in Alberta, about the pastor in Alberta, yeah. right?
Yeah.
That's in prison.
Yeah.
And in this article, there was a claim that, at least in Alberta, the evidence is really powerful that more people died as a result of the shutdown. And actually, according to this article, a significantly larger number of people died as a result of the shutdown than died of COVID. Okay,
so that's what it would appear. Yeah.
Yeah. So now you've got a moral element on either side of the equation. Okay. And I've thought about this myself, even in the States, and I've wondered, well, if this shutdown has caused so much evil in people's lives that just following it by rote. Because, you know, it's the government, and choosing to obey the government is then choosing a course of action that brings harm to other people. And so this is where the judgment comes in, where I think it is legitimate to say no to the government and yes to another course of action that is more moral because it harms fewer people.
But it's morally sound.
Well, in principle, I'm just saying it.
Yeah.
Possibly, and this is where the individual has to draw the conclusion that in any given situation, is obedience to the government going to cause, in this circumstance, more moral harm than disobedience? And if that's the case, then the disobedience is the morally appropriate line of behavior. Okay.
Now, I've
spoken in kind of very broad theoretical terms here because I'm not making decisions for people about these things. I'm just trying to show that sometimes the what appears to be merely pragmatic concerns do have moral dimensions to them. And and when a course of action by the government causes tremendous moral harm, then it may be it's entirely legitimate to disobey the government and obey the course of action in which the greater good is accomplished.
Sure. Okay. That makes sense to me. I was following like where that pastor was arrested. That's up where I do have family in that area.
Uh-huh.
I don't reside that way, but it's certainly the hot topic now, right? Is where do we as Christ followers draw
the line?
In the sand,
yeah.
So to speak. And initially, based on my research, I was like, well, you know what? We need to be limited. We need to be restricted for the benefit of our society to love our neighbor. And that was a great motivation for me.
Uh-huh.
But as I do my homework, I start to see other data. And I go, oh, well, it would seem to me at least that now perhaps, and I know this could be a pretext for other things. It doesn't have to be strictly a COVID matter. But, when you have more information, shouldn't we then respond with that information? Even if our government is not responding, we can say, well, no, I think the time of this is over because of X, Y, Z, and there's sufficient data to support one's argument.
Well, here's what I would, pardon me for interrupting, I just want to jump in for a moment, and then I'm going to have to go to break here quick or to another caller. Okay, and that is the, it is entirely legitimate in my view to take those kinds of things into consideration against the government's decree if that we are not simply talking about pragmatism. You know, what's more comfortable or what will accomplish some non-moral end more effectively. But if we're talking about the moral impact, that's different. And so that's why I brought up the fact that, well, the government might say one thing, but if we slavishly obey it simply because the government says, and the Bible says to obey the government, then we are not looking at the other side of the equation where we are not to obey the government when the government requires us to violate a higher moral principle, famously in the book of Acts, preaching the gospel. But you mentioned loving your neighbor. So loving your neighbor is the way this is kind of characterized. Obey the government because it's loving your neighbor. But if it turns out that it causes your neighbor harm, which a case certainly could be made for the way this has been prosecuted in the last year, well, then I think that changes the moral equation.
Got it. Okay. Fantastic. That helps me out a lot, Greg. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Yeah, I'm glad for your call there, Kim. And thank you so much for calling in on that issue. Let's. I'm just going to jump to Nathan in Oregon. Okay, let me get the button. Is that all right? Oh, I put my finger up to Derek, and the reflection in the window out of the corner of my eye of my own finger looked like Derek putting his finger up to me, like, hold on there, don't do that. Anyway, all right, here we go. Nathan in Oregon, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called.
Thank you for having me today.
You're welcome.
So I have a little bit of context for the situation.
All right.
I have a friend who I believe is a very spiritually wise person. They have a lot of wisdom that they've given me that has helped me in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But then when they begin to falter and struggle and I provide wisdom to them, they kind of respond with, I don't know, or I don't really care. Not I don't care, but like, so they don't really know how to apply it to their life, nor do they feel the drive to do that. So I guess my question is just how would I talk to an apathetic Christian and, you know.
Do you think that's the problem, apathy, or they don't see the relationship of your counsel to their circumstance? I'm not clear on that.
I think it's more just apathy, because like when I talk to this specific person, but there are a few other people I have in mind, but when I talk to this one specific person, they hear what I'm saying.
Go ahead.
Yeah, they hear what I'm saying, but they just don't apply it. They just, I ask, like, so what are you going to do about that? And they say,
yeah,
I don't know.
I see. They're not motivated to change.
Right, yeah.
Well, I think dealing with apathetic people is one of the most difficult tasks that we have as Christians, because they don't want to listen. You could say all kinds of things and they go, just shrug their shoulders. So what, you know, they're just apathetic. That's the danger of apathy. And I for the most part, it isn't like I have some panacea, some clever little trick to get people motivated. I find that people get motivated regarding spiritual things in particular when they have a reason to. And since apathy is is somewhat of an emotional thing, but it also might be a lack of motivation based on lack of interest or lack of reason to be motivated in that particular direction, then when something happens in their life that challenges them in this area, then their motivation increases. Okay, so people may be very apathetic about spiritual things or about ultimate issues, say. Let's say teenagers. Teenagers are notoriously apathetic towards these kinds of things, generally speaking, partly because they don't think they'll ever die. You know, they can think that far ahead. Then there's a terrible accident and six teenagers in the local high school get killed. Well, this brings all of that stuff that they weren't interested in thinking about because they couldn't even conceptualize death somewhere in the future. Now it's right there in front of them, and it rattles the whole community. And now these things are meaningful, and now there's more motivation to think about these things. So it's, a lot of times it's tragedy and hardship that's brought into somebody's life that gets them thinking more about ultimate issues and motivates them more to think about it. And so the RX then for that kind of person is not anything you could do in the moment, but if they're members of your family or friends, then you wait until something disastrous happens to them, and then they are open to hearing something more from you. I mean, I really wish I had a clever rejoinder regarding this kind of situation, but right now that's all I can think of. You know, it's sometimes these things are circumstantially determined, Before I became a Christian, my brother, I was raised in the Catholic Church, and there was no spiritual substance in that experience for me. I left when I was about 18 years old and then embraced the world in the mid-60s. And then my younger brother had become a Christian through the Jesus Movement, and he told me about it, and I had no interest in it. I had no need for it. I didn't care. I had my own life while I was living it, and I didn't want to. I didn't want God spoiling the party, until my party got spoiled in a different way. And my girlfriend of 6 years, my high school sweetheart, moved on, and that decimated me. Now, that did not cause me to come to Christ immediately. What happened is it caused me to look more carefully about my own life and more ultimate issues, which eventually led me to Christ. That was a stepping stone. So even in my own life, that was a kind of a factor. And sometimes that's what it takes. God works in different ways.
So would you say a good idea maybe then is just to keep pushing faith, wisdom, and Scripture, just keep pushing Jesus, but then also just be patient.
Be patient. Bide your time. And it's okay to talk. My brothers kept talking to me, you know. But don't be discouraged when you get shined on. And then when I shine him on and I moved on and okay, we're not talking about this anymore, all right? And next time we'd see each other, then it just seemed there he was with the gospel again talking about Jesus. And I don't remember all of the details of our conversations, but a couple of things do stick out. One was the message of grace, which I hadn't heard before. Another, it was that Mark was really deeply and profoundly convinced this was true. And I remember him saying to me at one point, Greg, the things I'm telling you are true. Sooner or later, you're going to find this out. I just hope that when you do, it isn't too late. I remember that precisely. That was tremendous confidence he had. He was not deterred by my rejection. And the other thing that stood out is he really cared for me. He was really concerned about my eternal destiny. It was obvious. And so those are three things that I think got my attention: the gospel of grace, his complete conviction and not being afraid of me, and his love for me as an individual. And those are the things that God used eventually, along with these other experiences, to get my attention and to move me towards himself. So that's the best I can offer you at this point, Nathan.
Well, that's all right. Thank you very much.
All right, buddy. Thank you for calling. I hope that's helpful to you. Let's take a quick break. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking, and we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic, and subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group, helping STR-trained Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
All right, moving right along here, Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind as I do every Tuesday evening from 4 till 6 Los Angeles time. That would be PDT Pacific Daylight Time now after last weekend. Let's go to Oklahoma and let me find my buttons here. Emily, welcome to the show, Emily.
Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for taking the time to answer my question.
Well, I don't know if I'll answer it, but I will take the time.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes.
I'm a big fan of your show and have been greatly helped by your ministry.
Thank you so much.
I have a question about how much time to spend with a non-believer. I have friends who are ministering to non-believers, but it seems more like their non-believing friends are bringing them down more than their helping them.
Wait, I don't understand that. And you've been spending time with, you have a ministry to non-believers, but I didn't catch.
Oh, okay. I said I have friends.
Yeah, you have friends.
Who,
that's good.
Sorry. I have friends who are ministering to non-believer friends, and it's kind of like a friendship missionary. Friendship.
Yes, that's good.
And so I'm just, it seems more like their friends are bringing them down than they're actually helping their friends. And I was thinking of Psalm 1 that says, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked or stand in the way of sinners.
Right.
Or
sit in the seat of scoffers. Right, right. Psalm 1.
So I know that we are to be salt. We're commanded to be salt and light and to win the lost. But I'm just trying to differentiate between...
Sure.
Your friends bringing you down or ministering to non-believers, and when you're, I know that their influence makes a difference.
Right, right. No, that's a very good point. And
okay.
But when you're quoting Psalm 1 there, it's talking about kind of, it's the issue there is not hanging with non-believers, it's being like them and following the counsel of the non-believer. It's stand in the seat of scoffers, sit in the seat of scoffers, stand in the way of the path of sinners, walk in the, you know, I get it mixed up, I got to go back over it. But it's so, the idea is that we are not conforming ourselves to that way of life, thinking like they're thinking. Notice the contrast in the second half of the psalm, which says that, but rather it is the, oh no, I got to find it. The second half of the psalm offers the antidote, basically, for that, and that is the one who delights in the law of the Lord. And in his law, he meditates on day and night. By the way, it's not talking there about who he's hanging out with. He's talking about what influences his thinking and his decisions. And the person who either the solution or the options are twofold. You could walk in the counsel of the wicked, and that's expressed in different ways in that first verse. Path of sinners, seat of scoffers.
Right.
It is basically, you could have that inform your thinking, or your counsel can be the law of the Lord, and that's the contrast.
Of the Lord. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, when we are engaged with non-believers in our lives, and different people have different amounts of that. I mean, I have less, given my circle of friends and what I do, and many others listening have a lot more. There are two things, and I wrote these down anticipating your call, that we need to keep in mind, and maybe this will help. One of them is that we need to make sure we are getting fed the truth. Okay? So if we are hanging with non-believers all the time, and we have no source of truth that is feeding our thinking, then that's a problem. Because we are starved for spiritual food that's healthy. And we are exposed to spiritual food that is not healthy. All right. And that's the other half where we have to be fed, but we have to be careful that we are not fed or indoctrinated is what I mean by the non-Christians we're with. So if you think of these two contrasting sources of instruction or guidance, the counsel of the wicked or the law of the Lord, verse 1, verse 2, okay, we need to make sure we are getting an adequate counsel of the law of the Lord so that we are not taken in by the counsel of the wicked. That's kind of what I was getting at. Those are the two things.
Okay, yeah.
Make sense?
The other thing I was wondering about is the verse that says, bad company corrupts good character in 1 Corinthians 15:33.
1 Corinthians 15:33? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay, let me go there quickly.
Okay.
Got it. Okay. And that passage says, this is a chapter on the resurrection, it says, do not be deceived, bad company corrupts good morals. Oh, yeah, that's another proverb.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and this goes along with what I've been saying. If we are hanging out with bad company a lot, we are taking counsel from them, it's going to corrupt our morals. It's just fairly, very straightforward.
Yeah.
Parents know this.
Yeah.
And that's why they're concerned about who their kids hang out with, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is this is on the side of the equation that I mentioned of not taking the counsel of the wicked. If what you do is spend your most important time hanging with and trafficking with secular folk, the chances are better that you are going to imbibe their ideas and begin living by the counsel of the wicked instead of the law of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, Emily, thank you so much. Let's go to Buena Park, California. And I'm so self-conscious about the buttons right now. I don't want to lose people. Okay, there you go, Elena. Welcome
Hello.
To the show. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for answering my call.
You're welcome.
Okay, my question is there a biblical command for practicing following Christians to attend or become a member of a local church?
Well, strictly speaking, the way you put it, there is not a biblical command of that sort. The closest that you can come to is in Hebrews chapter 10.
Okay.
And in Hebrews chapter 10, the writer there tells us that we should not forsake the assembling
gathering.
Of ourselves together, okay? Now, that is the only verse that I can think of right now that explicitly identifies the responsibility of Christians to hang out with each other.
Yes.
However, having said that, implicitly— and this is quantifiable. We go through the scriptures and we read 1 Timothy chapter 1. And there Paul gives Timothy directions on how to choose elders.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Elders
who is our
elder? Elders for who?
Yes.
The local church, of course. And we see that also in Titus, same kind of thing. And there is a presumption of community that Christians are in community with each other in intimate ways, evidenced to some degree by the frequent use of the phrase one another.
Mm-hmm.
Encourage one another and exhort one another. And all these one another's. Well, you can't be doing the one another's if we're not hanging out with one another.
Right. Yeah.
And we also see when Paul talks about the gifts that we are to give to the local church, in 2 Corinthians, he says, you know, you gather this together and then you provide it on the first day of the week because these are when Christians are gathering together. And the gathering together of Christians is also featured in the Lord's Supper, you know.
Uh-huh.
So those all reflect the practice of Christians hanging in community together. We see that in the early chapters of the book of Acts, description of the Christians hanging out and praying and the disciples meeting each other's need and, you know, taking care of the widows and all of that. So I guess I'm saying, even though there is not an explicit verse commanding this, except for the one I cited, we have the example of the early church prominently displayed throughout all of these passages that I've mentioned and a bunch more that yes. make it clear that there are local communities that Christians are attached to, the Church mm-hmm. at Corinth, the Church at Ephesus, the Church in Rome, etc., etc., where they are in community with each other. They are being taught by pastors, teachers, and gifted people in the mm-hmm. church, and they are being disciplined. 1 Corinthians chapter, 5, you know, Paul directs certain discipline to take place in the local church, etc., etc., etc. So this is the kind of the warp and woof of the Christian experience in the New Testament is to be part of a local body.
Okay, so our local body could be our Bible study group, our close-knit Christian friends that we spend time with, and does that count?
Well, I think it counts. I think that what Paul describes as a kind of a full-fledged local body is one that has elders and pastor teachers that are guiding it. Okay. So I think, I mean, membership, this is a common, this is a modern notion. Are you right. members or not? I mean, I go to Living Oaks Community Church. My pastor now is Austin Axon. All right.
Uh-huh.
And as far as now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think I ever officially signed on the dotted line to say I'm a
right.
member. But I'm
right.
a functional member there, though many times I'm in somebody else's church on Sunday. That
right.
is the place I spiritually call home. So,
yeah.
That's I do have a local church that I identify as my own home.
Okay.
And they have elders there. And so I think that what biblically is in view is that we're part of a community that has a certain structure that accomplishes
right.
particular ends in our lives. And
okay.
that provides for worship and for community and for discipline and for sharing the Lord's table
mm-hmm.
and teaching especially. So, I guess I'm behind the notion, though I don't really care that much if you become official members. That's just
yeah.
somebody's function
to
and
be
that's
a
what
part
they
of
want.
A church.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So are we being disobedient? My husband and I are not a part of a church, but, I mean, we're actively in Scripture and listening to your podcast and research, gathering, studying in community. We're not ignoring our community, and we're the hands and feet of Christ helping out one another.
Sure. Well, I'm not that concerned about what you just described to me. I
uh-huh.
think there may be some purists who say, well, if there's no elders there and you're not having the Lord's Supper and baptism, the two sacraments, then you're not really functioning as a full church. But a lot of people do have
yeah.
the Lord's Supper, you know, in those kind of environments.
Right.
I would be mindful of that. You know, I think it's easy to, when you're not tied to a specific group, but you're a little here, a little there and whatever,
uh-huh.
and you're getting spiritual feeding, which
yeah.
is important, I get a little concerned that it may be too footloose and fancy-free. So there may be some liabilities to that. But
a little bit too much freedom.
It's just that you're unattached. When I say freedom,
yes, okay.
I mean not just ambience or liberty. I mean that a lack of being attached to a particular group that you call your church family.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Do our friends qualify as our church family?
No, you can't have
no.
any friends that are Christian. That doesn't count. No, the church is a large enterprise. It's a communion of the saints.
And we're all a part of the church, right?
Yeah, and if your friendships with other Christians represent a kind of cohesive unit, then
uh-huh.
I think you're, you know, by and large following the principle. But I do...
Okay.
I mean, there is some part of me that pausing a little bit and saying, well, yeah, that's all well and good, but there is something different about an established local community
right.
of Christians that we
Absolutely.
Characteristically call the local church. And and I think that it might be good to think about doing connecting in that way.
Absolutely.
You'll be safer if you do that.
Yeah. Yeah, we watch online Jack Kidd's church, but it's a little far from us.
Well, online's not church. Online
right.
is online.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. I prefer to meet in the building.
Yeah. You need to be rubbing shoulders with people, you know, be able to look them eye to eye.
Absolutely.
It's just a huge difference when you do that. So anyway, so those are my thoughts.
Okay. That's
okay.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, Elena. I'm glad to talk with you. Let's take a quick break here and then come back for our final callers on Stand to Reason.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love #STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. #STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, #STRAsk. That's #STRAsk. All right, friends, final segment here on Stand to Reason. And I got a couple of challenging calls coming up, so let's go first to Joshua in Kingsfield, Texas. Hi, Josh.
Hello, sir. Hey, Greg. It's a pleasure speaking with you, sir.
Pardon me?
It's a pleasure speaking with you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. That's sweet.
Yes, sir. So my name is Joshua. I'm from Kingsfield, Texas. Oh, I have a real quick question that kind of halted me in search why. If you can please forgive me of my ignorance, but here's my question, sir.
Okay.
In Numbers 31, it says that the Israelites were commanded to destroy the Midianites and not the Moabites. And in Numbers 25, it says that the Moabites caused Israel to play the harlot with Baal. Also, it was the Moabites who reached out to Balaam to cause to curse the Israelites for them in Numbers 22.
Right, right.
So my question is, why destroy the Midianites and not the Moabites?
You know, that's a good question, and maybe you've heard me say this before, that sometimes the why questions are really, why did God, why didn't God, are hard to answer because they imply that we know something about the mind of God, and oftentimes that has not been revealed to us. Now, these passages, actually, for me to do a more thoroughgoing job, I'd have to reacquaint myself with the circumstances there in Numbers. But Amy did draw my attention to Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 9. Okay, now this actually comes afterwards, after the time of Numbers, because Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law, right? It was given once to one generation, then they had wanderings. That first generation died off, the wanderings we see in the book of Numbers, and then we have the second generation ready to take the law, land. And in Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 9, this is what I read there. Then the Lord said to me, "Do not harass Moab, nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar," that would be A-R is the way it's spelled, "to the sons of Lot as a possession." Okay, so there's a statement there at the beginning of Deuteronomy where it's clear that God, for the reason he expressed there, did not want the Jews to bring down any destruction on Moab. The Midianites were a different category, apparently, as this relationship with Balaam, because they were looking to, I'm just going by my sketchy memory here, to bring a curse down on Israel, and this, you know, and then God retaliated by sending the Israelites against them. But in this particular case, God says he does not want them to fight against Moab for the reason that he gives here. They're not going to take the land of Moab, so he says not to fight against them.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you're happy with it. It makes me curious about what else is going on there. So anyway, I hope that's I hope that is helpful to you. Thanks so much.
It has. Thank you, sir.
Okay. That would be Joshua, and that would be line six. Okay. Here I am again with the buttons. Okay. Thank you. Derek pushed the button for me. Okay. Let's go to Wisconsin and Tucker, my favorite state, Wisconsin, although not this time of year so much. Hi, Tucker.
Hey, Greg.
Hey. Where are you in Wisconsin?
I'm in a little town called Verona, just south and west of Madison.
South and west of where?
Of Madison.
Oh, I see. Okay. So that's south.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes,
I like
indeed.
The North Country better, personally. But the further north
I
you
like
go,
all of it.
The further north you go, the redder it gets politically.
Mm-hmm.
That's anyway,
sure.
That's another issue. What's on your mind, Tucker?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been listening to your show for about a year now, and I've heard a fair bit of your story, and I know that you married relatively late in life.
I did.
I'm wondering what advice you could give to younger adults like myself who are either not planning to get married or not expecting to marry, you know, drawing on your experience.
Well, I mean, I always wanted to get married. Are you saying how did I comport myself as a single person for so long? And what advice can I give in that category to somebody who probably will, like yourself, will be single a while because you're not really interested in getting married? Is that, am I reading you right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I can only half relate to this because there is some advice I can give. But the way I gave it back then, and I got invited to speak to a lot of singles groups. And I'm not sure why, because I didn't get married until I was 48. Actually, I had my 48th birthday on my honeymoon. And so here I am, 47, 46, 45, whatever. It's like I'm this old guy who's still single. Why do they want me to talk to singles groups? People are going to say, I'm going to listen to everything he says and do the opposite, you know, kind of thing. But one bit of I think that a lot of singles were frustrated. And this isn't your case, I imagine, because you're not chomping at the bit to get married. You're trying to think about how you can make the best use of your life. Even so, and I tip my hat to you. Generally, there is a, and this might have to do with my own past, but there's a little engine running called SEX, you know, that makes it being single difficult. All right. And Paul makes it clear in 1 Corinthians 7 that, you know, this is a thing that's going to drive people to matrimony because that's the only place where you can have that urge satisfied in a way that's proper. And but if that doesn't drive you, fine, you could have undistracted devotion to the Lord. And that's a benefit of being single. Now, for me, it was more like undevoted distraction, you know. So I knew I was the marrying type, though it didn't happen for a long time. But here's the advice that I gave to those who were single that I spoke with, who most of them were not like me, like you, satisfied in that state of affairs and not chomping at the bit. We're more like me, you know, frustrated. And so what I said to them was this: let's just say that for the sake of speculation, that you knew that you would never get married. All right? So now, of course, these are people I'm talking to that want to get married but aren't, and they're frustrated, okay? What if you knew that you would never get married. Let's just say that was a fact. I'm stipulating that, that you knew that you would never get married, okay? Now, with that knowledge in place that you are never going to get married, here's the question I'm going to ask you. What would you do with your life now that you know that you are never going to get married? Answer that question. I give them some time to think about it, maybe talk about it, whatever. I don't know. Okay, whatever it is that you decided that you would do if you knew you were never going to get married, I said, do that. I mean, it's pretty simple and straightforward. Do that. Just go ahead and do it. And it may be that you never get married. And therefore, now you are doing the thing that would be most satisfying and fulfilling and proper for you as a single person living the rest of your life unmarried. It may be that you end up getting married, but at least you're a moving target. And this is the way I thought of it for myself. I wasn't going to wait around. And in fact, that I was being productive in a way that God prospered over those single years gave me more visibility in the body of Christ. It actually made it more difficult for me to find a mate. And people thought, well, look, you're up in front of everybody and blah, 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 and you have visibility and you can have the pick of the litter kind of thing. You know, I don't know where they got this idea, but the fact is, when I go to places, I'm the last one to leave, because when I'm out there talking, all of a sudden I'm done working and everybody's gone. So it isn't like I have this access to people to meet them and whatever. And plus, you don't want to be the person who's trying to deliver a spiritual message and offer a spiritual meal and then, you know, appear to be hitting on the girls. You know, this is just, this looks bad. So it was all, it didn't help me. It didn't make my circumstance easier that I was being productive in the particular way that I wanted to be productive, which is in the ministry concerns that I pursued. Now, I for much of that time, I was making a living doing something else. I didn't get into full-time paid Christian work, until 1985. Now, I got married in 98, so there's still a lot of time, but I was doing other things, you know, and then when I got, I was actually 6 years into Stand to Reason when I got married, and I was on pastoral staff before that. So I was trying to be productive in my life. I was trying to make my life work as a single person and then let God take care of the rest. When I say that, I don't mean that I was passive. I wasn't. I would go out on dates and stuff like, but I kept my hands to myself, you know, and my lips to myself. I would say characteristically, there were a few exceptions, but not many. And so I was, you know, for 25 years I was celibate, trying to live the way God wanted me to live. And I just had to live with, in my case, was the frustration of not being sexually satisfied on the one hand, and the frustration of being alone. Because I wasn't just looking for a paramour, a sexual partner, I was looking for a life partner to experience a satisfaction of sharing a life together. And so that was that was part of the loneliness that I felt. And it was very lonely for a long time. So, I don't know about your temperament, Tucker. Maybe, and there are some people that are just fine moving along. My son, my stepson, actually, he's 38. He's still single. And he's, you know, interested in getting married, but he doesn't seem to be chomping at the bit. He's got a very satisfying life, and he's actually in Alaska right now he's doing a traveling nurse kind of thing. So spending 3 months in Alaska, doing that up in Fairbanks of all places. It's really cold there, you know. But he's having an adventure, and he goes on a lot of adventures, and so he is capable of fulfilling, living a fulfilling and satisfying life. Apart from a steady relationship with a woman. And I think, well, it's good for him. I mean, I don't relate to that personally, because I have never been like that. But some people are disposed that way, and that's fine. My point is, I think any Christian should seek to be productive for the kingdom in any circumstances they find themselves in. That doesn't necessarily mean they have to be in full-time Christian work. I wasn't for many years, but I was seeking to make a difference for the kingdom, even though I was working as, you know, different things, carpenter for a while. And that's what mattered to me, ultimately, because those are the things that bear fruit that remains for eternal consequence. And that's what I was interested in.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's really good advice. I think the part you talk about loneliness is kind of the sticking point for me, the part that I'm least settled with, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the other parts about finding things to work on, living, mm-hmm. living without waiting for marriage.
Yeah,
those I've at least kind of squared away mentally. Do you have any specific advice for?
Well, I'll offer this. Yeah, I'll offer this. I only have about a minute to go, but I did have a couple of relationships that were large, but were for the most part platonic. I can think of two of them with women that were had very good friendships, and we actually did a lot of things together. We would go to events and to movies. We'd go to dinner. We'd hang out a lot, but it was platonic. There was a close friendship. There was a lot of enjoyment of hanging out together. And actually, sometimes these may turn out to make very good marriages, because if you're good together in the day-to-day, even though the fireworks aren't going off, even when you get married and the fireworks had been going off, I mean, those sputter out after a while to a degree, and it's cyclical, right? So all married people know that. It's the other qualities that are more important, for lack of a better word, the friendship qualities that cause durability, that create durability in a relationship, and that's what you want in a marriage, especially when children are in view. You don't want to be, in a certain sense, wedded to the emotions, no pun intended there, but you want to be married to someone that you can do life with well. And in my case, I had some people I hung out with, like I said, in particular, that were just really great companions. It turned out that didn't work out long-term, but it did make for nice fellowship and communion with those people during the times that I was single. And so that's just another thought. All done here, though. I appreciate the call, Tucker, and all done with my... There's that music. I'm going to pause so I'm not talking to hear it. Hope those thoughts were helpful, Tucker. Makes me think back on those days. Interesting. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. You give him heaven. Bye-bye now.